Welcome to the Wild West Podcast. Our guest today is photographer, filmmaker, surfer, author, and traveler of the northern latitudes, Chris Burkhard. Chris got his start as a photographer for surfing magazines, but he's parlayed that into this whole incredible Burkhardian empire. He's published a best-selling surf photography book and a best-selling children's book. He directed a documentary on hunting for surf spots across Iceland. It's called Under an Arctic Sky. You can watch it on Netflix. He's given a TED Talk. He has 3.5 million Instagram followers. He's only 33 years old, but he has masterfully carved a career for himself. It's something he gets asked about a lot, how he built his brand and how he leverages social media to open up new opportunities.
All social media is, all Instagram is, it's a texting device. It is a communication tool. And if you are not there to communicate with somebody, you'll never find success. There's no amount of hashtags or follower this or, you know, all these like tricks and things people try to do to gain followers. It's like, yeah, you want to find success, just communicate.
Chris is often traveling for work, but I was able to get him in our San Francisco studio recently to fill me in on how he built his career. He explains his fraught relationship with Instagram and how he manages his massive following, his philosophy for finding success in a crowded industry of photographers and influencers, and most importantly, just how he came to own and love a pair of alpacas that live with him and his family at his home on the central coast of California. I had a great time chatting with Chris, and I hope you guys enjoy listening. We'll get to my conversation with Chris Burkhard in a moment, but first, this brief message. All right, we're back. Now onto my conversation with photographer Chris Burkhard. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Chris. It's great to have you.
Stoked to be here. I'm really grateful. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, no problem. It was good you can make it over.
Yeah.
We were just talking about some of the testing that you were going through today to learn a little bit more about your metabolism and like your rates of lactate.
Exactly.
Lactic acid. So have you done anything with your, have you done any testing or analysis of your microbiome over the years?
I'm sure I have. I can't specifically remember like the results of that, but yeah, that's kind of been something that I've been really intrigued by and interested in many ways. But I mean, if somebody was to offer it, I'd always be like, oh yeah, I'd do that. I'd love to learn. You know, I'd probably forget it in like 5 minutes, but I think there's like a little bit of an addiction nowadays because so much information is available. We almost just like want to know it all, regardless of if we're going to adhere to those, you know, like those sets of that piece of advice or not.
Totally. Yeah, it's funny. I know there's so much into personalized medicine now. One of the reasons I asked is I used to work at Outside Magazine, mm-hmm. and one of the things that we did before I left is we got in touch with the it was called the American Gut Project, I'm pretty sure, at UC San Diego, and
wow.
then we reached out to a bunch of adventure athletes and asked them if they would like send their poop to the American Gut Project and then like share the information with us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure, Well, it's all like very preliminary. It's pretty nascent. And so it's not like somebody's going to, you know, learn that if they ate oats every day or something like that, that they could run a mile under 4 minutes. You know, it's nothing
right.
But one of the basic findings that came up was just that people who spend a ton of time in the ocean in salt water, so surfers, can have significantly different bacterial makeups in their guts.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, so that's why I was asking, because you spend a lot of time in the water, yeah?
Yeah, I used to spend more, for sure. I feel like these days I guess growing up, it was all about the ocean, right? It was like, oh, you know, every single day the ocean was more of a babysitter than anything else. And just, I was, you know, growing up, that's how it was. But nowadays, I kind of find myself climbing a lot more and cycling and doing yoga and other things, you know, to stay active and busy and this and that. And then when I get in the water, it's kind of, I don't know, you know, it's like that thing where like you grow up and you have this thing you love and you become, you know, professional at that thing. I guess you could say a surf photographer. And so all the best days, you're not in the water, you're shooting, you know, and so you're kind of sitting there staring at all the very best days, and it kind of desensitizes you in a way. Like, I love and admire the ocean. It's my favorite canvas of all time, but there's some bit of magic that's kind of been lost, I guess, when you like have seen so many good waves that it's challenging to like be in California and be like, yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm not like super motivated, you know, as motivated as I was, I guess.
Yeah.
To go surf.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to ask you because you described something similar in other reports that I've read, talking about how you got into shooting and filming and surfing in like the northern latitudes, mm-hmm. In the Arctic, in Iceland.
Yeah.
And it seemed like there was something similar going on there too, where you were a surf photographer traveling all over the place, but just kind of like it lost its luster somehow.
Yeah, yeah. And that's sort of was the preface, I guess the thesis of my TED Talk kind of thing was that was really that, you know, even the most glamorous job, I thought I had the dream job. Or I thought that what was the dream job, which I eventually attained at you know, in my 20s, you know, traveling around the world, shooting surfers on these white sand beaches in the tropics, you know, like the glossy pages of magazines I used to flip through. I was literally like, I was in those pages. I was there.
Yeah.
And it was amazing and it was incredible. And for a couple of years, yeah, it really did satisfy a part of me that I was so eager to satisfy. But like anything, you know, it became mundane. It became monotonous. And it also felt like I was using, you know, some sense of talent that I felt like I had to basically sell this fake sense of adventure. You know, there was Wi-Fi and fine dining, and you'd have this, you know, vision in your head of this big, grandiose, you know, adventure, and you'd turn around and there'd be a high-rise hotel. And that's kind of what you were being sold, and I felt like I was helping sell that. And it just sort of made me feel a little icky inside, I guess you could say, like dumb it down. And I started seeking out other places that had been kind of written off as too cold, too remote, too dangerous. And I felt and I knew that just by where I grew up, I feel like we're all a byproduct of our environment. And I grew up, you know, running up and down the dirt roads of Central California and looking for surf and, you know, this and that. So it felt kind of like a return to what was important to me. And, you know, return to your roots, I guess you could say, in some way. But ultimately, that sacrifice of going to those places and being willing to give something of yourself, and it was risky, and you had to decide who you're going with, and that was even more important. Like, the people you're with, like, you know, you can't just be like, oh, well, anybody can handle this, you know. It required more of you, and because it required more of you, it meant so much more. And I think that was a huge draw of why the Arctic, and specifically what the Arctic asks of you, that made me so attracted to it.
Yeah,
I don't like to be cold. Like, let's just get that out of the way.
I was gonna ask. Okay.
No, I mean, like, I grew up in California. You know, like, I'm in Pismo Beach, like 70 degrees all year round. You know, like, I don't have some penchant for like, oh, I love to freeze. Like, no, like, I suffer just like everybody else. I'm on those beaches and there's snow everywhere, and I'm like, this sucks. But I love what you can create there, and I think that's has been sort of the addiction that I've chosen. So.
So you're not like a Wim Hof devotee?
No, I'm totally not a Wim Hof devotee.
Oh, really? I thought you would be.
I very much do follow Wim's advice. But like anybody, it's just like I struggle with it. You know, like, yeah, just getting into a cold shower sucks. Like, there's nothing about it that feels good, or like jumping into a cold lake or this and that. But I do love the feeling afterwards. And because I feel like I've learned to put aside some of like the immediate like negative effects and look towards the long term, I've you know, been able to embrace it a little more than others.
Yeah. So Iceland, it's not just the surfing that makes it awesome, but that's what you kind of focus on. Well, at least in your film, The Arctic Sky. But what are the other, not to ask for like a sales pitch of Iceland, but like, what are the other cool things about the Arctic environment that, you know, makes it wild and worth exploring?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, like, it only takes going there once, right? For someone to really fall in love. I can't imagine, you know, people going to these places and just being like, yeah, it was kind of cool. You know, like, I guess what it is to me is that there's still so much to be discovered. Even in a place that's just absolutely littered with tourists like Iceland, you know, like, you'd walk 20 minutes, 10 minutes down any trail in any direction, nobody's there.
Mm-hmm.
There's still huge corners of the country that are absolutely empty. And I feel like there's less people, you know, it's more raw. The environment, I think, provides greater photo opportunities. And if you are a photographer, or you're somebody who likes to take pictures, I guess the one, like, the biggest, you know, in some ways I always feel like I've just pulled the wool over everybody's eyes. I've always told them, like, I'm not a good photographer by any means. I've just been the person willing to go to these places.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is it's not hard to take a bad picture when you go somewhere that nobody's been. And so 10, 12 years ago when we were searching for surf in Iceland, it was very new and raw and real. And it was just like, yeah, you couldn't take a bad picture. So I feel like that, to me, I still feel a lot of that when I go to the Arctic, wherever it is. There's some, you know, being on an empty beach is like really amazing experience.
Totally.
And I guess that's kind of part of it. So,
when did you first go to Iceland?
It was like 2005, something like that, maybe a little earlier than that. But
okay.
But prior to that, I was doing trips to like remote Canada, like Haida Gwaii, Queen Charlotte Islands, mm-hmm. Up to Tofino and kind of that area. And I think that was kind of my foray into cold water surfing. And growing up in California, obviously, I had traveled up and down the coast, and I was a byproduct of cold water surfing, but it wasn't really until that first trip to Iceland, I think, that really like set in stone what the potential was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've been back like dozens of times since then.
34 times, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Have you seen anything change in that time?
100%. Yeah, tons of stuff.
What kinds of things are?
It's hard because I've been there. I've watched as, you know, the volcanoes erupted and tourism's changed. You know, when I was first going there, they were transitioning from being a fishing-based economy to trying to basically dam their rivers and sell geothermal energy and aluminum smelters and this and that. And as time went on over the 2000s, right, tourism has become their largest economic source, which is funny because it's actually preserved its nature, right, because it was at a risk. So I've seen a lot of changes. I've seen, you know, beautiful places that were once very, very empty all of a sudden now have guardrails and tour buses, and it's crazy. But I've also been very, very privy to the fact that, like, these places are now also protected. There's national parks, and there's people raising up their voices to create a national park in the Highlands. None of that would have ever happened without tourists, ever. And I call me, you know, optimistic, but I guess I've always just been, like, more of a realist that, like, yeah, I love these places. They're sacred to me. They're special, this and that. But in the essence of it being sacred to me, I feel like it could be sacred to everybody if you let it. And so the reality is the only way to protect places is to hope people can experience them and want to raise their voice. It's also one of those places where I think that because we're so indoctrinated by seeing images and this and that, we compare our experiences to the experiences of others heavily. And so you often, people are like, oh, it was a good trip, you know, but I didn't see that or I didn't see this. You're like, well, that seeing this or seeing that or photographing this or photographing that kind of determines whether the trip was good. And I think that's kind of one of the scary things I think about the day and age that we're at with social media, is that there's kind of this comparison sort of scenario where we find ourselves in.
I was going to ask you about that. So that's a great transition.
I know. I'm just like going all these random, I'm a very scatterbrained like conversationalist. So I'm sorry about that.
No, I think it's totally interconnected. I think that the way that these places have been broadcast on social media and with these incredible photographs and just how popular Instagram has become, it makes them feel more accessible to people, you know, like a lot closer to home, I think, than they
I mean,
did
I'm
before.
Sure you've had like a relative or somebody you know who you're like, I never imagined they would travel. They're like, we're going to Iceland. You're like, what? That's, you know, it's really cool. And I think that's actually like a really special thing that like I'll be on the plane and I'll hear people from like random rural parts of America like over there, and I'm like, you probably never would have experienced this had you not seen it and made it and it felt accessible online, just like you said.
Yeah, it's interesting. So one of the things you do is you teach photography courses.
Yeah.
What do these people ask you, like, in the age of social media about how to become a photographer or an adventure photographer, like an outdoors landscape photographer?
It's a great question. It's funny, it's one of my favorite topics is just talking about social media. But to be honest, I don't wait for someone to ask questions. I kind of try to give the answers before the questions come, because I want people to understand very clearly that the path to becoming a photographer is not get a social media account, then buy a camera, then figure out how to use the camera. Like that's not what it is. Like social media to me, I started out my career in editorial, shooting for magazines and being on staff for a number of magazines, and really it was the opportunity to share stories that were not being shared in the magazine. I would go somewhere, you know, in Vladivostok, Russia, and I'd be stuck in jail for 24 hours and deported, and I'd be flipping through the magazine months later and I'd be like, where's that story? That was so crazy. That was the, you know, most pivotal moment of my life, and it just wasn't there. And so I started to use Blogspot, and I started a blog, and I would share these long form, you know, like things, and then all of a sudden, you know, Tumblr, then Facebook. And then all of a sudden, Instagram. And I was like, and for me, it's always been an extension of storytelling. It's been an opportunity to share these behind the scenes, interesting moments, to give a piece of yourself. And what I really try to teach people, like, if I could boil it all down, you know, into kind of podcast format, is that I lead them through this kind of social media, like, I guess you could say workshop, where I try to, you know, pass on some of the things I've learned and categorizing which kinds of images I guess you could say perform well, because the reality is we're asking people to experience something on like a 2 by 2 inch screen.
Yeah.
Does that mean that all types of photography are going to work well? No, it just doesn't. I would never want to put a detailed black and white image that I want someone to really digest and take in. That's not where I want to put it. I want to put it on a wall or in a gallery or somewhere where they actually have to absorb it. So I try to go over like why cognitively do we respond to certain things. And then the golden rule to me is to not describe to people what they can already see. For some reason, people go out there and they spend this time, this energy, all this effort, you know, that they you know, brave freezing cold weather and go create something really beautiful. And then they share it online and they're just telling you like, oh, they're describing exactly what the picture is. Well, the problem is you have eyes. You need to use them to experience this format. It's visual. That's one of the things about it that makes it so great. And to lose sight of what you could share about that experience, the visceral experience, the why, the who, the what inspired you, that's like such a lost opportunity. And I think the thing that really makes me just like cringe internally is when someone does, you know, go through all this effort to make something really amazing and beautiful, and then they just tell me that the mountains are calling. They must go, right? And so just share some random quote that doesn't mean anything to them, you know, or maybe it does, but if they do, then tell me why. Mm-hmm. So it's called digital storytelling, and that's like kind of how I always want to frame it, because I feel like it's the only way I'm able to justify using such a soul-sucking platform at times, you know, is just to feel like, and to know that, yes, it actually can have a profound effect on people's lives, you know.
What is your relationship with Instagram? You have like 3.5 million followers.
Yeah, it's usually I'm sharing, you know, I'm really just sharing outtakes of my work. Like, and I outtakes of my work, whether it's commercial, whether it was editorial, whether it was shot on, you know, purely kind of personal project or something like that. And I usually it's a mixture of just me trying to, you know, what it comes down to is there's three types of people that I'm kind of aiming to serve.
Yeah.
People that want to do what I'm doing. So I try to give those people a sense of like how I shot what I shot. Like, here's the backstory. Here's this is how I did it. So you could do it. The second one is people who just want to be entertained. They just want something beautiful to kind of drift away a little for a second. And I want to give them just something like interesting and unique and maybe tell them a story. The third thing is people who kind of want to know more about me, and I want to, and those people I usually aim to like give them a piece of myself, a little more in depth, a little more like, you know, sometimes it's challenging to be that honest and truthful online because it's a scary world out there. But I feel like those people I really love to share just like the personal insights I've gleaned along the way and things about my life. And so, yeah, I've kind of categorized it into those three groups. And that's mm-hmm. kind of, I guess, my relationship is usually the voice I'm trying to speak through, like is filtered through one of those lenses, I guess you could say. But I try to really, I'm a dad, you know, like I've got a family. I try not to be online too much. And my whole work is basically focused on being on the computer, emails every day. So I don't want to be like sucked into Instagram a lot. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it can be this this maintenance effort.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, so you feel like you're the janitor of your own, marketing department.
Totally.
Yeah.
So is there an element of that to it? Like, oh man, gotta feed the beast today.
Yeah, you know, my favorite comment is always like, man, how do you do it? How do you answer all your DMs? And like, because I answer personally most of my DMs if it's an honest person asking a real question, 100%. And I tell people, I'm like, here's the deal. Like, you don't need more than 20 minutes on Instagram a day. What you're actually doing is you're going on there, you go to the explore page, you start aimlessly scrolling, and you start occupying your time with just random stuff. Maybe you're looking at like Kook of the Day or some like fail video or something stupid. Like, the reality is that's what you're really doing. That's not Instagram. That's not using it as a business tool. That's not using it as a way to connect to people. All social media is, all Instagram is, it's a texting device. It is a communication tool. And if you are not there to communicate with somebody, you'll never find success. There's no amount of hashtags or follower this or, you know, all these like tricks and things people try to do to gain followers. It's like, yeah, you want to find success? Just communicate. you know, what if you like were to go to your friend's house and open the door and blast, blurb some message in the door, you know, open the door, yell out at them. And then by the time they had a chance to come to the door and speak back to you, closed it. That's what you do every time you share something and then you fail to respond to any comments or connect people. So I see it as a way to connect, and I enjoy people. And this is usually where people kind of like, they start to look really sad in the workshop, is that I say, like, if you don't enjoy people, you will never find success on social media.
I hesitate to call you an influencer on Instagram, but I think you probably fit the qualifications for that on some level.
The way I've always seen it is this, is like, if most of the work you do as a photographer requires you to promote what you're doing, what you're shooting, then you're an influencer. If most of the work you do as a photographer doesn't, then you're not an influencer. I think that you can have influence without being an influencer. I feel like we have these two, you know, modern day words, influencer and content, and those are the two words I hate more than anything in the whole English, you know, dictionary nowadays. But I understand that I have in some capacity a voice of influence, and I just hope that I can use it for good and not just to try and turn income, you know?
Yeah. So that's a great distinction, actually. I hadn't really thought about that. But it does definitely, I think you can kind of tell the influencer when you see them versus the person who's just kind of sharing parts of their life.
Yeah, it's like the reality is like I my business model breaks down into six revenue streams. Social media being the last one. And in terms of like diminishing revenue. Now I could easily flip that around. I could sell crap every single thing someone asked me. I could try to make as much money as possible and that would be great, but I would lose part of my soul in the process and it would be terrible. But I think that the grand scheme of things is like I like the purity of the platform, and I like being able to just know that people can go on there and I can just give them something fun to look at or something meaningful or advise them on, you know, some thing I've learned or realized or whatever. And I just think that if you get away from that too far, then it's you become dishonest in many ways. So and I agree. Like for me, there's so much stuff I shoot that I do for work that I would never share, mainly because like I don't think you want to see the latest tech campaign we shot for so and so. Like I just don't need to put that out there, you know?
Yeah. Do you have multiple Instagram accounts?
I have my account, Chris Burkhardt, and then I have a personal account that was personal, that sort of became impersonal because a lot of people followed it.
And so somebody blow it up?
It's really just like a behind the scenes account of like life on the road and my house and my alpacas. And I share a bit of my family on there, and I share a bit of like where we're kind of currently at if we're on a job or a shoot somewhere. I try to like make it more, because I work with an amazing team. We have a staff of 7 employees, and I mean, all the jobs that we do require, you know, a great team of people. So I just try to share like those experiences, you know, and it's fun. Like I love what we do, and I get a chance to work with like some of my best friends. So it's a lot about that, you know, on the road and whatnot. But it's funny, yeah. There's definitely some more off the cuff, you know, blue collar moments in there.
Yeah, I was just curious.
What did you do outside, by the way? I'd love to know.
I was an editor there.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
When I was there, we covered one of the first things that like I had assigned when I was there to cover that you had worked on was your children's book, the picture book.
Oh, yeah.
It came out. I think it was about the Northern Lights, like kind of exploring the Northern Lights.
Whole book was really just – I made it for my own two boys, my kids, but it was a way to like inspire children to seek the answers to hard questions in nature, really. Like, you know, adults are easy. You like give them pretty pictures and like, you know, a message, and we grasp it. But with kids, you have to like distill down the message to some sense of purity so they can really like understand it. And it was really a cool process to like try to go through that and make a book for kids. And I'm honestly, it's still like the most successful project I've ever done. And we never really envisioned that being so.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Just like, you know, kids continue to be born apparently. So, that's a plus. And I think, you know, a lot of the other books I've done have been like surf photography or, you know, the California Surf Project or Road Trip of California and things of that nature. So this was like a very different message. There's no photos, all illustrations. Mm-hmm. Really great illustrator, David McClellan, and we were able to work with. And really it just – I think that it there's a timelessness to it that I didn't expect, and that's really cool. And it's in like all these national park gift stores and Patagonia Books.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's really cool. I'm stoked.
Yeah, that brings me to something I wanted to ask you, which is your approach to your career as a photographer has been very varied. You've done all kinds of stuff, like from the TED Talk to this commercial work to the children's book, the documentary. Mm-hmm. So how do you keep it? How do you keep it so varied? What is it about that that is appealing to you?
Well, the funny thing too is like everything you just mentioned is really on, from the basis of like of personal work, you know. And I've always really put emphasis on personal projects and meaningful long term ones, not ones where you're like in 2 weeks this is gonna be done. It's like no, this is a 2 year thing. From the very onset of my career, I published a book, The California Surf Project, at like 22, and that was I won a grant for the best upcoming surf photographer from this thing, and I basically used that grant money to do a trip, and I you know sent the images to this editor, and yeah, I had a book very young, right? But ultimately that experience, it was published by Chronicle Books in San Francisco, and to be honest, that kind of set the stage for like, wow, these long-term projects can actually be really fruitful. And like that book is still out and published, and it got me so much work and it got me so much notoriety at a young age. And what I realized was like every career has this sort of ebb and flow. It's never just like this linear climb. You know, it's and usually it's not like this linear descent. You know, it kind of does these peaks and valleys, and you kind of can pick up speed on the low, and you know. So for me, it's like I did the book, the California Surf Project, and then we made a film called Arctic Swell that went online. And that was again personal project, free. Like I didn't get paid for it. I did it with the company. They just wanted to do it. That got me my TED Talk. My TED Talk got me this. This got me this. Under Arctic Sky, like, was cool. Such a fun documentary to make. I did that trip as a part of an assignment, but like the film itself was 100% self-funded between me and my partner, and it did really well, and we did not make any money from it. But just because we didn't make any money from it doesn't mean that it didn't do very well. People always ask me, you know, like, so as a filmmaker, I'm like, whoa, I'm not a filmmaker. Filmmakers make money from films. I'm not a filmmaker, right? So for me, that was more just like the most expensive college education ever. But in the grand scheme of things, there's so many things that have come from that that will pay for itself and have been lucrative. So my recipe for success has always been invest in yourself first. Like in your portfolio, you want to go shoot something? You want to go shoot, I don't know, aviation photography, planes flying over, you know, Iceland's rivers or whatever? Pay for it. Like nobody's going to just think, oh, my, you know, I had an idea that you might be good for this. No, like I've spent so much of my own money making these portfolios, building these portfolios, only for them to be able to come out and then all of a sudden get hired as a specialist, as a professional in that field. But that's because I've invested. So I guess that's always been kind of the thing, is like I've invested in personal projects. Those personal projects have benefited me long term. I'm trying to work on things that not only are meant to stand the test of time, but also introduce my body of work to new markets. And that's really what the California Surf Project did. It was in Barnes & Noble and Urban Outfitters and blah, blah, blah. And it was everywhere. People that would never have known my work as a Chris Burkhard, the fledgling surf photographer shooting for Transworld, would have never known my work. So I was getting commercial work from that. And then everything I've done has tried to disperse, right? And so that's kind of what I'm the way I see it and the way I try to operate. That was a very shortened version of like an hour long, you know, explanation of how I do what I do, I guess. So sorry.
No, that was interesting.
Yeah.
What do you have coming up that you can, anything that you can talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm doing an expedition to these remote Russian islands off the coast of Kamchatka with an amazing, talented crew of filmmakers and scientists and whatnot. It's a place I've always dreamt of going. I've been researching this place for like 5 years, and it's by the grace of God, somehow we were able to secure a boat to go, and I'm really excited about that. I'm also shooting a film on a really good friend of mine in Iceland. His name's Eli, and it was about he's a photographer in Iceland, and it was about his near-death experience he had, and just like, you know, how the ocean saved his life.
Well, it was like a feature-length documentary, or
it's
short,
a short
or?
Film. It'll be a okay. short. It's more of like a festival piece, okay. like cut, and we're just doing it. It's just a piece of all. I mean, it could be the funding. Amy's out there. They want to fund it. Let me know. But the reality is, like, it's just something that calls to me. Like, I just want to do it. This is like a personal project, you know. Pretty much everything I'm sharing is a personal project. And then my wife and I are working on another children's book. That's kind of, you know, I think, you know, in this day and age, it's like sometimes people can't look past the fact that that my children's book is called The Boy Who Spoke to the Earth. So people want to have a book about girls, and we're like, it's for everybody. It doesn't matter. But we're going to make one that's a little more focused on like girls' journey and what maybe some of them struggle with. And my wife is just super talented, so she's been writing that and working on a memoir as well.
Oh, man.
It's published. It's supposed to be published. It's published by Abrams, my publisher, in like a year and a half or so.
You're so young.
Yeah,
a trust memoir me. Already?
Yeah, I don't want to. I never wanted to do this at all. This isn't my idea. But to be honest, I thought in the beginning that a memoir was, you know, the same as an autobiography, when it's not. You know, it's about a specific period of time and a significant experience. And really, really, this book is meant to be about, you know, finding self-worth and kind of, I guess, pursuing your dreams and really relationships. You know, for me, it's a lot about just like what my drive was to do what I did and who I felt like I had to prove it to. And I think it'll be a really valuable book for anybody, for any young person of any kind of wanting to just understand, have a greater understanding of like, of sort of life, triumph, struggle, love, and like, you know, feeling accepted and unaccepted. So yeah, it's a really personal story. It's I'm really excited about, and I think it's gonna really do a lot of good. Other than that, another book on Iceland's glacial rivers, which hoping to publish in the fall. I've been working alongside Halland Did, which is a nonprofit in Iceland to create a national park for the last like 6 years, and so this is just an extension of that. And when I'm not doing any of that stuff, I'm just hanging with my kids, trying to like be a dad to a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. So. Yeah.
Yeah. You have a home, 2 sons, wife in Pismo or outside Pismo.
Just outside Pismo, or Rio Grande. So we have the full breakdown is 2 horses, 2 alpacas, 2 cats.
Yeah,
a dog.
Had to
4 chickens.
About the alpacas.
Yeah, this is what happens. My wife's like, yeah, let's get a little land. Okay, let's get a little land. And then all of a sudden you're like, let's fill this land with a bunch of random animals. I'm not an animal person at all. My wife has fully broke me down and made me into an animal person. Like, I was that kid who, like, got bit by dogs and was scared of dogs.
Oh, okay.
And we got a dog, and then we got this, and then all of a sudden I'm like, I was terrified of horses, and I'm like, now I own a horse. I don't know how this happened. But it's also been, like, really, I guess you could say, like, a healing and amazing experience for me to, like, learn to love in general. But alpacas, oh my gosh, so they're just the most incredible animals. We got them because we were like, we need something to clear this land because, you know, California, you
right.
have fires, like it's, we live in a, you know, fire prone area. We have 5 acres and there's a lot of dry stuff. So the alpacas were to eat all the grass.
Okay.
At first, we kind of weighed it out. We're like, goats crap everywhere. They're kind of unruly. They're mm-hmm. sometimes they're hard to like, you know, get, and alpacas are like good with kids. They're watch animals. They like are the kindest. They'll like give you kisses. They're so sweet. They're fur. You can harvest their fiber, and their fiber's like some of the most like the nicest on the planet. And they're freaking rad. They poop in one area.
Ooh,
like
that
like
is
they
nice.
They poop in one little tiny like 1 foot by 1 foot. Like they're very clean in that regard. So I'm like, I don't know, that to me as a neat freak, you know, that kind of like makes me happy, I guess you could say.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
it's I've heard something about alpacas. I've heard alpacas are not the friendliest creatures.
Llamas are not the friendliest creatures.
Okay.
Alpacas and llamas are like almost like 2 completely different things
in
many ways. Like llamas are more likely to like spit, and they're a little more aggressive, and they don't think they're as attractive either. That's just
maybe that's what I was thinking.
Maybe that's me. But usually alpacas are pretty loving creatures. Yeah, yeah. At least ours are. You should come see them. They're cool.
They look awesome.
Susie Q.
We did that story, and I saw the photos that came
back. Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And you have, like, your arm wrapped around the necks of one of the alpacas. Yeah. And I was like, that looks like the life.
It's pretty rad. They're cool, man. They're, like, they're very zen, you know? Like, and they, like, are kind of one of those animals. Like, if you're in a bad place, they're, like, not going to be attracted to you sort of thing. So, I don't know. It's good for me, I guess. But.
Cool, man. Well, this has been great. I don't want to keep you any longer. Now you got more stuff to do.
I'm super grateful to come by. It's cool to chat. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Chris. Thanks very much again to Chris for making time to come on the pod. If you want to keep tabs on what he's up to, he's a great Instagram follow.
Look for him at Chris Burkhard. If you want to follow what I'm up to with California travel, I'm on Twitter at Greg R. Thomas. Or if you've got questions for me or suggestions for who I should bring on the pod, email me at gthomas@sfchronicle.com. Wild West is part of the San Francisco Chronicle Podcast Network. Find us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you like us, please throw us a rating and a review. Our music today is a track called Fuzzy and True by the Mini Vandals, and it comes courtesy of the YouTube Audio Library. See you next time.